So I have finished the formal part of the presentation. I really welcome your questions, or if you folks want to talk to each other about some of these issues, that's fine with me. And Hillary is good to point out to me is that maybe I'm kind of trying to run through a few things. Pacific Life Community was something that was active in the 70s, and it was a good combination of people like Chet Myers, Jim and Shelley Douglas up in the Northwest, on the emphasis of Archbishop Hunthausen saying, I will withhold 50% of my taxes so that it doesn't go to nuclear weapons, et cetera, et cetera. And so good people in the Bay Area, Lockheed Martin in combination with the Trident Base. So there was a lot of activity between Vandenberg all the way up to Seattle, Tacoma. So the Pacific Life Community unfortunately went a little dormant by about 1981, 82. And so I thought it would be good if we got folks kind of back together. So when I said Pacific Life Community, that's what I meant, is the one that took place previously, went dormant, and has now had a kind of a resurgence. What was it, 2008? The Pacific Life Community was held at Casa Maria and Vandenberg with the help of Mary Becker and others, and Catholic workers. Is Mary part of this group?
Yeah. She's so sorry she can't be here today.
Yeah. Yeah, I've got a question. What is your thought on chaplains? We have a very good friend who was decisive in helping me form my conscience. He was a Catholic chaplain at Fort Campbell, Kentucky, and he had been in Vietnam, and he saw, and that's why, you know. So he was like you, but he was wearing a uniform. Where do you see this?
This is the thing. I guess the term also is chaplain can also apply in a lot of different areas, right? Prisons have chaplains.
Yeah.
Military institutions have chaplains. The way I see it is why do you have to be a part of that, well, let's call it an institution? Why do you have to be a part of it? I would never refuse the sacraments to anyone. I guess it's a little rough when you're in the middle of mass, and I guess a policeman walks up full gear with guns and all that. It's stark and it's probably distracting, but I'm not going to refuse the basis because they're carrying a gun. But a soldier as well. This is somebody who I think is in a crisis.
Yeah.
Most soldiers in this day and age, either that or they're not awake. If your conscience isn't saying something to you. And of course, that's what we're doing a lot of brigades and all that, is trying to reach out to soldiers and say, look, you've got to be able to call yourself back. So the role of the chaplain in your life, that's a rare story. I wish there were more stories like that. So why does he have to wear a uniform, be paid by the military, and 30 seconds now, and I want you to I've seen a situation where they have contract chaplains, where, let's say in this case, a priest comes in from either the local parish, maybe that parish isn't doing so well, and gets a stipend for coming in to Long Park, you know, celebrates liturgy, communion, or whatever, and then isn't a part of the institution. And then in the Army, and I want to give you a chance, the Army, the base commander has a lot to say about the morale of the troops. And you start talking about, actually, it's illegal. You know, the Constitution doesn't back you up when you actually are on a base, because you're ruining the morale of people. You don't have freedom of speech on a base. Outside, yes. But on a base, the Supreme Court decided that you can't, that's not going to stop you, by the way, but the Supreme Court says your rights aren't protected on a base because you're going to ruin the morale of the troops. Please.
I think one reason, I was in the Navy, and I was a physician on a nuclear ballistic submarine. And I don't know a single person who served on that ship who felt that they wanted to fire a missile. Their feeling was they were there to deter the firing of a missile. But talking about chaplains, soldiers and sailors often serve in areas where proponents of nonviolence don't have access. You know, you're on an aircraft carrier in the Pacific Fleet, and you're gone for 6 months at a time, and you can't just call in a chaplain from the local parish or go see them.
That's right.
So there's a very good reason, I think, to have chaplains in the military. And paid for by the government.
Mm-hmm. Would it be necessary for them, maybe there could be a volunteer situation, but they're actually part of the whole military, from uniform to being given officer status, and all. Do you think that part, do you think that's necessary? Because a soldier coming, or a seaman, or an airman coming to them for a moral rundown on what's happened, isn't it lopsided on the part of the chaplain?
I don't think so, because the chaplain can pretty much speak his mind. As a physician, mm-hmm. I was only accountable to my commanding officer for the administration of my department. He could not tell me how to practice medicine. I was only accountable to the Bureau of Medicine Surgery in Washington, D.C., on how I practice medicine. So I think chaplains are in the same situation. Mm-hmm. You know, they can only be accountable to the commanding officer for the administration of their department.
And in the case of Tom Heck, he's saying that's really a minority story, unfortunately. I've heard a lot of horror stories of them just saying, oh man, you know, you're not really a man unless you take up your...
Yeah. I think this is connected, what I'm going to say. I think that right away it seems obvious to me that a lot of our clergy, this is what you're saying, connected what you're saying, are also patriots.
Well, the hierarchy is somewhat a little bit more progressive than the pews on several social issues, like, for instance, the death penalty,
mm-hmm.
and even torture. A little bit more progressive.
But
in other matters, the clergy and sometimes follows the hierarchy of that, and they are a little bit more progressive than the pew folks. But then in other cases, it is different.
But I don't mean they're as citizens.
Uh-huh.
They're not just clergy. They're also maybe very patriotic Americans who want to serve in the military. So that, I think they're a little confused.
Yeah. I agree.
Yeah.
And that confusion, that's what it is. Because they're
torn.
Two things together. That's right.
They're torn. The gospel tears us.
Well, there were 10 chapels at Fort Campbell, and only one was run by, was a Catholic one. All the rest were evangelical, Baptist, Methodist, mm-hmm. Lutheran, Jewish, you name it. And this was the only chapel where, if you went into the chapel, there was no American flag at the end and the priest that was there, John McCaslin, said, well, you know, when General Birdsong puts a Vatican flag in his office, I'll put an American flag in my church.
I am some surprised and maybe a little disturbed at your concern about the person who is, say, progressive, who it also is called to be a chaplain, because it seems to me all of us are complicit all the time, and we try to hide our complicity. And here, at least, you have to see it. And, you know, what is always my challenge is to find out of the various complicities that I maintain, which of them can I even begin to shed a little?
Did everybody hear that?
Mm-hmm.
The complicity is worth, if we're really going to be a community, we've got to help each other with the analysis. It doesn't mean impose my view, of course. It means that we've got to help each other with a good analysis, but the implication is that we'll have to live with that analysis.
Yeah.
And so that's it. Just to get back to just one thing about evangelicals and Pentecostals who become
Baptist, whatever, yeah.
And there's this situation with Romans 13, and mm-hmm. some of you are familiar with it.
Mm-hmm.
There's, you get some folks in there who just, the lines of authority are very clear to them. God, and then a general, or whatever, or you know, and that includes the authority is very clear for them. So they're not as discerning and can't handle ambiguity like at least some a little bit more mainline Protestant, or even though they're becoming more and more popular, the evangelicals and Pentecostals. But the institutions love them because they just say it's coming directly from God. If we got power, it came from God.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really, really, and as far as the institution goes, they have their sets of keys, and sometimes they show they're actually extra tough on prisoners to show that they're not soft. You know, they kind of overcompensate. So this kind of thing goes on. I'm not saying this isn't necessarily a military thing, because I'm only familiar with the military chaplains from my childhood, but haven't been in there since. Where were we on questions? You were waiting for.
Yeah, do you think we've made any progress on nuclear disarmament?
No, it's worse. It's worse.
Because I understood 20, 25 years ago, both the Russians and, or Soviets, and the U.S. had about 12,000 nuclear weapons, and they agreed to get rid of half of them, and now each country has only 6,000. That's still overkill. But what can we do to encourage further reduction? I don't think it's realistic to think that we're just going to eliminate nuclear weapons overnight. But what can we do to get the numbers down where it's not quite so scary? And 6,000 is still scary.
Should I be fielding that question? I would tell you, go flip the fence and get in there. By the way, you know, surprisingly, you guys know this as well as I do, who is the big abolitionist among the presidents?
Reagan.
Reagan, perfect. Reagan was the big, that's what he wanted for his legacy.
Yeah.
Obama will turn out to be very, very disappointing in this area. His speech in Prague, and then currently in Kansas City, they're building a whole new facility, let's just use that euphemism, and in Los Alamos, there's something the size of 4 Walmarts, a new building for the research making the pits, the essential of the nuclear weapon. All this is budgeted, and it's to have a whole new generation of weapons. So there were Gorbachev and Reagan, and the thing that hung it up was Teller had convinced Reagan that we could get a shield, and Vandenberg is part of that, is that the shield would, just in case, protect us all from nuclear weapons. And there's only a 5% chance that would protect us from all nuclear weapons, but that's another technical story. So Reagan was the big abolitionist. But they were ready to talk about all of them. And it was quite a scene here in Iceland.
Well, I don't want to put you on your efforts of cutting fences. I think that's fine. Those guys charged you with trespassing because it made them look so bad. How do a bunch of octogenarians cut through three fences? What I'm talking about is, and by doing that, they decreased the publicity. So how many of us heard about it? I don't think very many. But how can we publicize this reduction in nuclear weapons and get it down to where...
I am sorry, because you're really asking a very good, the most valid question. Well, grassroots-wise, what is to be done? So,
yeah.
And there we're talking about trillions of dollars that are going into the pockets of the aerospace industry, who in turn give it to politicians for their coffers for campaigns, and it's very cyclical, but... please go ahead. Anyone want to either address this? Go ahead.
There'll always be some one person that's going to hang on to a weapon.
And, you know, I'll tell you, this is what happened to me. This is just so you know where I'm coming from on this. Is if you would have asked me in even right up to 1980, are you against nuclear weapons? Oh, sure, yeah. And what do you think? And, of course, at that time there was a big freeze movement on. And I just would have said, well, look, you know, the trouble is they're really here to stay. Too many wealthy people making more and more money off of them, and so they'll never, ever be gone. But they are immoral, and they're wrong, and sort of, so I was right, wasn't I? I was right, but what did I lack? And it wasn't until I crossed the line at the Nevada test site. And that was traditionally the first step in at that time, and it was very important, the first traditional step of nuclear disarmament or abolition was to stop testing. And then it went to, of course, to the computers at Livermore. However, the Russians stopped the testing, and there was a window of opportunity with Reagan and Gorbachev, as we were mentioning earlier. But the problem, is what happened to me in Nevada is I got hope. That's what made all the difference in the world. And I... Because you could have asked me before 1982, and I would have said, they're going to be here. people are going to want more money. Anyway, someone's going to hang on to make profit, etc., etc. And after 82, I said, their days are numbered. I don't know when it's going to happen, maybe not even in my lifetime, but more people will come forward and just plain old say no. And I don't know, spiritually speaking, maybe God has allowed us, to have that crisis averted, that they'd ever be used again, because that we're not totally wiped out and incinerated because of a handful of people that are still saying no. So is it good news? Go right ahead.
Oh, I was just thinking the other day, what companies, what individuals are making, I mean, they seem to go under the radar. We don't know names of, this company, and maybe I have stock in a company that's making arms. Maybe I don't even know.
Let me assure you is that every state, every cent of the hummingbird. They actually have them that size.
They do, yeah.
I hope it makes it out.
Maybe we turn all the lights off.
Will that
turn all the lights off.
Oh, I see.
It'll go the brighter light.
Is that the only door?
Open the door.
Oh, there's a window. But go ahead and watch them all. See if you can hear me. The sense that I have is that structure that has to be analyzed, and who's benefiting. And once again, I think it needs a tremendous amount of production. I'm not even talking about the schools, those budgets that have been eliminated, the clinics and hospitals that are needed, and the social programs. So I'm not even talking about, even good business would say, look, this is not a cornucopia. This has to end sometime. And the peace dividend should be, I vote at the presidential level or anything like that, but, Jesse Jackson was running for office at the time, and he was in a place like Iowa, and he asked the people there. He said, how many of you own Panasonics, tape players, record players, et cetera, TVs, et cetera, et cetera? And all these items, the implication immediately was all these items not made in the United States anymore. How many of you? And they all raised their hand in this assembly. How many of you have a Pershing missile? Well, no one raised their hand. He says, there you have it. We're making things the rest of the world doesn't either need nor want, and everything else is outsourced. So that's the economic analysis. Everybody in Congress has a piece of this, and to the point where the Weaponeers and Los Alamos Laboratories, Livermore Laboratories, that's where it starts. They're intellectual authors, and every dollar spent there is 300 in the industry. And then they have their friends, they're actually driving the policy. They're not saying reluctantly, you want us to make another nuclear weapon? No, their jobs are at stake. Mm-hmm. I think my solution to that is retire them all at full salary. Mm-hmm. We have a much more peaceful world. Mm-hmm. No matter how expensive that got, just retire them at full salary. But the other side of it is then once the Lockheeds and the McDonnell Douglases and the Raytheons, et cetera, they are actually driving policy too and convince the local the congressional legislators, et cetera, and all that money keeps going and going and going. You notice all the questioning, the cash cow of the Pentagon's budget is never, ever questioned as something that would be given up on, Mm-hmm. It's a given. And it's over 50% of the budget. And so I think the analysis is needed. Who are these people, the direct defense contractors who are allowed to donate money where they see fit, and it comes back in return to them with contracts. That's not the full answer, but we have to find out who it is. And believe me, we're tied into it. Yeah. Go ahead.
I think sometimes when we hear about this budget and the need for more money, what we're hearing is how they justify it is protection of our troops. Yeah. And we do want to do that. These are sons and daughters and so on that and people we know, and we don't want to deny them that. And so when that point is made, that seems like a reasonable justification.
And the question comes up in Israel all the time. What is our security? Remember, it's kind of a smaller scale in Israel. So what is our security? Is it a negotiated settlement with our neighbors, or is it to just keep, you know, pressing down, making open air prisons like Gaza? What is our security? Where does it lie? Do we keep having to send troops to thousands of miles away, whether it's Vietnam, et cetera, or Afghanistan? And what? Why is that supposedly our security? When in fact we know, Kathy Kelly, I don't know if you've ever heard of her, God bless her, she put it quite starkly for me, because she visits a lot of these places, we're making terrorists faster than we can kill them. So that spells out the security question loudly. And it's an unfortunate set because there are people dying in the meantime. So what would be our security? And then I'm sure the antagonism of other countries in the name of our consumption of oil and all that spelled out a lot. But please, any other comments on this? These are very important questions.
Commonweal Magazine about 3 weeks ago, no, a month ago, had a very scholarly article by a SC professor, The Total Cost of the Iraq War. And it's an eye-opener. It's an eye-opener because everything is hidden. We keep thinking, oh, well, we can't have Social Security. We got to get rid of some of these social things. And they never mention the war. Right. And this guy's documented. It's really good. I'll bring some copies next week.
And one of the most expensive items in the war this is Rumsfeld's doing in part, is that all that money that goes through the Pentagon, just why can't the private sector get some of that, right? Mm-hmm. So all these contractors, for instance, and the privatization of it all started, and he basically opened up the floodgates for them to start making, and so you have the majority of that money goes to contractors. Yeah. And they get six figures. These are not just sort of the local Keystone cop walking the beat. These guys are really cost a lot to keep in the field. Mm-hmm. There was another question. Keith, do you want? Well, Deborah was just before you. Keith?
Do you know what percentage of the military budget is spent on finding new weapons?
Let's see.
And this is because they always argue it's for the safety of the troops. But how much of it is for developing new weapons?
I guess you could take a look at the budgets for the labs. Initially, that would be where I would go. And then you see that the project from there goes out and then they're developed. So, now you need a figure on that. I just keep this figure, it's been trillions of dollars for the past 65 years, of course. But. And then there's the delivery systems. So it wouldn't be just the warhead itself, but the delivery systems as well, and that's involved planes, boats, etc. So the analysis of the budget report. Go ahead, Keith.
Lately, it's really impressed me that people in general are so afraid. So where are we going to find security if I'm scared? It's in the military. And it just seems until people are willing to say, yeah, we'll follow Christ.
Yeah.
We'll give up this empire security. That even old, what's his name, the German, Goering, said, if you want to get people behind you, scare them. Use fear. And I think that we do.
Thank you, Keith. That's very succinct. I mean, where is our spirituality in this? And that's where the so-called pastors, that's where the crunch is for them. The pastors have to instill in us, or do you have the idolatry of putting your confidence in the weapons, or is it in God? And what do you stand to lose, I guess? There was one question over here, and then...
I'm taking it from a kindergarten teacher's perspective of what you're saying. Yeah. I was a kindergarten teacher when 9/11 happened. And the favorite game that year was, they would build the blocks for kids, let's say, let's blow up the towers. I've always reflected on that because they saw so much of that. They were innocent kids. And that was their reality. Let's like blow up the towers. They would build the blocks and take the airplanes. And I would try to say, kids, let's build blocks for building blocks. But in some ways, we were starting the, producing some terrorists, because it was my experience that as the years have gone on since then, kids are so used to violence. And if you put anything on TV, even like on a rainy day, they glaze over. It's just their whole body, their affect changes, they just glaze over. And when you were talking about the people who are sending the drones, it was just a grown-up kindergartner, as far as I'm concerned, because they don't make the, it's not reality to them. And I think that's how we're getting, people are not, it's not kicking in that this is really violent for teaching kids violence, because,
It's the hummingbird.
Go ahead.
First of all, I want to thank you for everything that you said this morning and for the courage you have to follow the call that you've been given through your experience. That in itself is a witness to the gospel. I want to thank you for that. And then on the other side, sitting here thinking, well, I'm never going to be jumping fences and cutting fences and I'm not going to be spilling blood and hammering, so what is the gospel call for me? I agree with everything you say about nonviolence, about nuclear weapons. This chapter is addressing, I think, issues that are more common to most of us in living our everyday lives. I look at the life of Jesus and try to say, Word of Life has, the question behind Word of Life for 33 years has been, who is it that you say that I am? And each one of us has to answer that individually. I look at Jesus' life and, he didn't go into the temple and, spill his blood there and hammer on it, but he was the temple whose blood was spilled for us. And this chapter deals with the ways and the model that he presented that was countercultural. It talks about hospitality and welcoming the alien and the stranger and building communities that did the same. And that's more along the lines of probably what 95% of us are called to do because it's the life situation that we live in. I'd love to see you go into the Vatican and spill a little blood there and hammer. church or in the institution of the church, we are supposed to have models of community so that when things break down in the world and the violence is there, we can shift our gaze over here to another way of life that is practiced. But when we shift our gaze over here, it's the same thing. It's the political as anything else. So the institution isn't modeling for us in its structures what you're talking about either.
Yeah, so this is it. This is where the shepherds, they have a role in this. You might not even be Catholic, but the Petrine ministry is supposedly to help us in that communication with each other. And we've seen abuses, and don't even leave it with the papacy as well. It's just that many of our, the Cardinal Spellmans of the world, I don't condemn him because he's probably a product of his time, but what an influential person. He's called the Wall Street Pope. A tremendous one person, and I think for the sake of his soul, there's been so much has happened, So that, I agree with you, and I find that very challenging, and that's why to be in community in this day and age and to really, really take care of each other, that's radical. And not just cozy take care of each other, but really looking out for the alien and the widow and the orphan in our midst. That's what's very converted. But we are between these two things. This is an ongoing and it's sustainable, and we have examples, and then every once in a while, you may not be convinced by me, and that's fine. But I know a lot of you would probably say, well, I can't defend with my life, but I know a lot of you, if you were convinced that you were saving the life of another person, if you were convinced of it, I know that a lot of you would not hesitate to lay down your life. It's just that you need to know that the action that I'm going to take isn't going to save a life. That's what I need to know. And then here I am dealing with a very abstract issue of nuclear disarmament. Although we know that how concrete it is affecting our lives. So I'm just attempting in here, to get a little bit more, sinews of connection here. And I think resistance is what gives hope. Is that not everyone has to do plowshares. But the model of conversion is common to both of those items there. What's going to convert? What's going to sustain us? this community. Sure, go ahead.
Where the model of spilling your blood and pounding of the metal, that model, where does it come from?
From Isaiah 2. Isaiah 2 and Micah 4.
Sorry.
They shall beat their swords into plowshares.
But how did you latch onto that?
Well, that was Molly Rush's inspiration. She had been, you know, speaking amongst, I guess, either scripture study folks and all, and introduced it. You know, we don't, people who do a plowshares action just don't walk into it. They get together for several months in preparation.
Yeah, then, you know, just call them to us.
Yeah, let's go. Let's get together. So there's a preparation period, and that's supposed to be a disarming of ourselves before we do disarming. So the ego can get involved, and you can have some rough edges need to be worn off of that, and how you function and good does works and plays well with others, kind of thing. And so she had heard about this and introduced it to the group, and then they prayed over and found that they wanted to adopt that as the symbolism that was at stake.
Because that symbolism is so Old Testament and so foreign.
Oh, wow.
To I think to our society, does it really send that message?
Well, I guess that's a good. You're eager to answer.
Isn't there a statue constructed? I don't think it's the Christ of the Americas, but between Argentina and Chile, that they melted down their weapons. Part of the peace agreement at one point, they melted down their weapons and built this statue of Christ, and that's the quotation that's on the...
See, there is that mentality, isn't there?
I think that...
Well, one thing, sure, it better be work, and it breaks my heart to see it. Who do you think gave the Isaiah 2 Swords to Plowshares monument to the UN and the United States? They went back to Russia. Well, actually, Russia or the Soviets. The Soviets took us for where we... You made it?
So
must be liking what you hear.
Anyhow, it's a heartbreaker. The that monument sits there, and it's very dynamic. I don't know if you've seen it there. It's on 42nd Street. It's a nice little calm area, shaded, and a very dynamic figure beating a sword into a posture.
I just need to be politicized about it, because I'm obviously not. It's not speaking to me. Doesn't mean it doesn't speak.
Well, remember, the essentialist is we, if we supposedly we can put a keg of dynamite someplace in and blow up the sword, but we're taking it and changing it. All that mental and all the resources that went into it and all that is going to be changed. It's like the same way we are.
Did those soldiers who put you on the ground for 4 hours have any understanding of what you were doing?
Well, we tried our best.
Would they like to speak?
Oh, well, we had to be ready to shut up, you know.
Would they give you water or anything like that?
No, initially. And they blind, you know, they have the hoods overhead. You know what they did? They took us out through the holes that we had made. And took us through the hole rather than the gate.
They took you through the narrow gate.
Christine, first,
are
you?
No,
I'm
not.
I was just thinking recently, I read that General Petraeus, I think, his wife gave him three cups of tea.
Yeah.
And it had such an impact on it. And I reflected, now there's a way where someone wrote a book that reminded the military that people are not objects, they're subjects. And so I'm thinking that's a form of protest by awakening of consciousness and compassion, a higher consciousness and compassion. It's a different way to go at it. And then I thought, well, that's what Father Keating and Richard Rohr are doing by bringing meditation. It's changing the consciousness from within and awakening compassion in people. And compassion is the only antidote to fear. And so if more and more people were to meditate, more and more people would be less numbed by the violence or feel compelled to need protection. So there's another way to go about it, I just thought, you know.
What was that?
You know, I think, again, not to decrease the value of your effort, but nuclear weapons are kind of a buzzword, you know, and a lot of people don't feel too concerned. The real problem is violence. And that thing about the kindergartners building towers and flying airplanes into it is where we need to work.
Right.
And we need somebody like a Martin Luther King or somebody with a really high profile to come out and speak against violence. Because it's not, you know, nuclear weapons directly haven't hurt too many people except in Japan in World War II. But all the sale of airplanes and M-16s and all of this other stuff, surplus submarines and
landmines
to foreign countries, have hurt a lot more people in recent times. And if we could attack the community consciousness and try to turn around this thing about violence, movies and all this stuff.
At least our meditation in kindergarten.
Yeah, exactly. We need to start with the kids when they're young.
Video games.
Because the whole green movement, you know, is really gathering momentum now because the kids are getting indoctrinated about
it. All of this. By the way, is this a hearing for us?
We're
going to
the FBI. That's okay.
You know, I do not necessarily want the last word. It is 12, but I did have one more thing to say, just as sort of a recap, was and whatever you want to do.
Yeah.
Is see what happened since the dropping of the bomb could be hidden to us, and that's a problem. And I'm aware, for instance, not in rebuttal, Jim, but I'm aware of the people who've been working in the nuclear industry. There's many mine workers radiated. There's been atomic veterans who've been radiated in tests at in various places, and people working in some of these labs that through the years come down with the various forms of cancer. The downwinders in Utah. This is even John Wayne and the entire crew are now in the death of cancer that were in St. George when their test had gone off and dusted them. Of course, whether we can prove that it was direct or not is another thing. But in all of this, what's happened is, and it is a matter of spirituality that cuts through this, the very thing that we use to get out of a difficult situation, and it's God-inspired, is our imagination. And you can hear that with the kids, and you can see it in the movies, and you can, all of that. The imagination would be the place, the human place that you would use to, what's the way out? What can we do? But what happens if the imagination is possessed?
Mm-hmm.
And I mean that in a spiritual sense, I also mean that in a kind of, even a psychological sense.
Mm-hmm.
What if the very thing that you use to get out of a situation can't be provoked anymore? That it's sort of, it's gone numb, or it is possessed to the point where it doesn't function as an imagination anymore, then there has to be times when you have to be provoked. I mean, that's not to justify any violence, it's only that that's the way, the nature of the way our imaginations work. So I come back to, and I'm not saying that this is the last word, thank God we have people right in this room right now going, what is it, we cannot do nothing.
Mm-hmm.
We can start with prayer. And we can sit together with our Bibles and we can do an analysis on what's going on around us, biblically or otherwise, what's happening to us, and therefore do something. But what's going to help our imagination get unpossessed? And that's, I think that's crucial, because I see it constantly.
Mm-hmm.
People either numb or asleep or actually so caught up in the violence that they don't even know it themselves. So that. How about that for a little 15 seconds?